Find other great podcasts like this one at podmoth.network.
Welcome to Bad Acts Podcast. I'm your host, Danielle Blinka, and today I am flying solo because Aaron is working very hard right now. Bad Acts is brought to you by the Podmoth Media Network. Check out Podmoth for more great podcasts. For extra episodes of Bad Acts, check out our Patreon at patreon.com/badactspod. There is a link in our show notes and membership start at just $1. You can also support Bad Acts for free by leaving us a positive review and by telling a friend about us. Before we hop into today's case, I need to give you a brief, exciting announcement. We are having a live show again. Yay! We will be appearing at our local pop culture convention, Comicpalooza, here in Houston. We have attended that every year for a very long time now. We usually go for the entire weekend. We presented there as Presenting Podcast back in 2022, and we are going back again this year for 2024. And I have to tell y'all, this year's event is definitely already shaping up to be one of their best. I have been watching the guest announcements, and there are so many guests that I want to see. First of all, they have the OG Charm cast coming, definitely going to be trying to get in on that panel. Also, they just announced that they are going to be having the OG actors from Back to the Future on there. So you can totally meet Michael J. Fox and Christopher Lloyd, I'm assuming. Very exciting for that. Also, you can come see us. We are going to be doing a live show. We are doing some cases that have to do with horror movies, inspired horror movies, or that have people pretending to be supernatural beings while they do these crimes. Also, we're going to talk about some more dum-dums that were wearing costumes, usually superhero costumes, while they committed the crimes that they committed. It's definitely going to be kind of a grab bag live show with more of a focus on crime than we had last time, but trying to keep it more pop culture convention friendly. So we're excited to present that to you and also just to meet everybody. It's super fun to see people out and about. So definitely come to Comicpalooza if you possibly can. You will not be disappointed. There is literally something for everyone. Spoilers, one of our favorite tracks is the literature track, so we will definitely be going to some book panels and some writer panels. Maybe we will see you there as well. All right, now on to today's case. Today, we are going to New Bloomfield, Missouri in December 2006. New Bloomfield is located in the central part of Missouri. It's a very, very small town. There are fewer than 700 residents that live there. If you look up Bloomfield, one of the pictures that actually comes up on Google Maps is literally just a pavement from a road, which is kind of funny. Also, there are some old-timey photos because of old-timey times where people were creating settlements that later on now we can feel weird about, but the pictures are still pretty cool. So you can go look at those pictures if you want. In New Bloomfield in 2006, 25-year-old Sarah Bonney and her husband, 28-year-old Ben Bonney, were building a life together with their 4-year-old little girl. They had just moved to Missouri from Iowa a year prior, and their daughter Jade was the light of their life. They totally cherished her, and they had a very loving family, which is awesome for both the couple and for Jade. And if you want to look up Sarah and Ben, I'm going to try to put this picture on our social, but they have a wedding picture from them, and they are both adorable. Like, they are the cutest couple. Sarah worked as an emergency medical technician and certified medical assistant. She had previously worked for the utilities department, for the city of Fulton and at a local florist. She enjoyed riding her motorcycle, camping, and attending a local church. Additionally, Sarah loved to entertain guests in her home. Ben worked as an auto mechanic. He was a guy's guy who also liked to spend time outdoors, fishing, hunting, and camping. As you can see, they were both into outdoor things, which kind of makes sense for the area because, as I told you, it's kind of rural with about 700 people living there. They also have a lot of wooded areas around this town, so it would be a great place to go do these types of activities, especially camping. Sarah and Ben were both really close to their families, and so when they got a disturbing phone call on December 23rd, 2006, they were ready to leap into action. This call came to Sarah from her cousin, Brian Dorsey. Brian was in dire straits that day because he owed quite a large sum of money to some drug dealers, and that debt had come due. Worse, there were two drug dealers in his house at that moment, and he was pretty sure that his health and safety were in question. He wanted to know, could he borrow some cash? Sarah was not the only person that her cousin had called that day. He had called around to several family members to explain his pickle, hoping that someone could cover this drug debt so he could dodge whatever consequences these guys planned to dish out. Like her other family members, Sarah was really concerned. She was like that, sweet and caring, a generous type of person that people knew that they could call when they were in need. Even though her cousin Brian was a mess, Sarah wanted to help him out. She couldn't risk letting something bad happen to him. Sarah told Brian that she would come help him out along with her husband, Ben. She also called a family friend named Darren Carroll, as well as someone else to help act as backup. The four of them went over to Brian's apartment to handle this situation with the two drug dealers and get them to leave. It all worked out, at least for the time being. These men did leave, but it seemed like a bad idea to leave Brian alone at the apartment just in case someone decided to confront him again. So the Bonnies invited him to spend the night over at their house. It was actually kind of a good time of year to invite a family member over because this was 2 days before Christmas, December 23rd, and the family had been really looking forward to the holidays. After all, they do have a 4-year-old daughter, Jade, and little kids at Christmas are adorable, right? You get all the Christmas stuff. You get to do Santa Claus. You get to have presents. You get to have smiley, happy face, make cookies. There's so many fun things to do around the holidays in general, but especially if you have little kids. And so they have this really bright Christmas coming up. They have plans with family members the next day. It's just a really nice time of year to have family around. So Brian comes over to their house that night. He was happy to be out of his house and out of his apartment, which seemed kind of scary for the moment, and at least for now, the drug dealers wouldn't be on his tail. That evening, Sarah and Ben entertained a small group of family members at their home, along with that family friend, Darren Carell. They all hung out in a space that the family called their shop. In the shop, the Bonnies had a pool table, as well as some other items that you would often find in a garage or a storage space, including a 20-gauge shotgun. When they went into the shop that evening, in fact, the shotgun had been lying on the pool table where it had been left from the last time that they used it. The couple actually had to move the gun out of the way so that everyone could play pool. At the time, this gun was not loaded. It was just there, you know, because this is their personal gun. As I mentioned before, Ben was an avid hunter, so it makes sense that he would have one. For the rest of the night, the group drank and played pool, just enjoying a fun night together. As the evening wound down, most of the family members left, leaving just the Bonnies, cousin Brian, and the friend Darren Carell. By that point, Brian had drank between 7 and 10 beers, so he was pretty sloshed. Still, he wasn't ready to go to bed yet. Sarah and Ben Bonnie tired out before their house guests. Since Brian was staying the night, they left him to see Darren Correll out. Now, it's important to note here that according to Brian, he believes that he had been awake for around 72 hours at this point, although we can't be for sure if that is true. His drug of choice had been crack cocaine, and he had been using it fairly steadily until he ran out of drugs and the drug dealers refused to supply him with more drugs until he could pay up. So he also says that he was going through withdrawals at this time. Regardless, he stayed up hanging out with Darren while the couple tucked in for the night, excited about their Christmas Eve plans for the next day. 4-year-old Jade was in her bed in her own room, and she was sleeping, just excited about those sugar plum fairies and all the presents that would be coming to her in just a couple of days. The next day, the entire family was going to be meeting up with family members, so they needed to get their rest. Meanwhile, Brian Dorsey and Darren Correll were still hanging out in the shop. When Darren finally left, Brian rummaged around looking for more alcohol, still not content with the amount that he had drunk so far. Since he normally used drugs, he might have been finding it hard to get the level of intoxication that he was used to. Finally, he located a bottle of vodka and started sipping. The next day, on December 26, 2006, Sarah, Ben, and 4-year-old Jade were all supposed to attend that family gathering to celebrate Christmas Eve. Sarah's parents were going to be at this gathering, and they were watching for the family to arrive. When they didn't come, Sarah's parents got worried. They weren't answering their phone, and there was just no way that they would possibly miss a Christmas Eve event with family members. It just wasn't a thing that was possible. So her parents drove over to the Bonnie house that afternoon to check on the little family. When they walked inside, they found 4-year-old Jade sitting on the living room couch watching TV. When they asked Jade where her parents were, she said that they were locked inside their bedroom. She explained that her parents just wouldn't get up, even though she had called them that day. Fully alarmed at this point, because, again, Sarah and Ben are good parents, so this isn't like them, her parents went to the bedroom to check on them. They found that the door was, in fact, locked, just like Jade had said. So, Sarah's dad forced the bedroom door open so that he could check inside. He could see that Sarah and Ben were lying on their bed, and there was a cover over them. He had to go into the room to check under the cover just to be sure that this was really happening. When he moved the cover, he found that both Sarah and Ben had been shot in the head and were deceased. Sarah was clothed in only a t-shirt. There was a bleach stain underneath her and on the carpet beside her side of the bed. Additionally, someone had emptied her wallet and had discarded all of the contents of it around her body. Her dad did check their pulses just in case they could be saved, but unfortunately they were both deceased. And so at that point, he decided that he needed to lead his wife and his granddaughter out of the house. But as he was checking on his daughter and son-in-law, something else traumatic happened that would later become a point of contention. The Bonnies had some pet dogs, and they were obviously very concerned about their pet parents. So, whenever Sarah's parents went into the bedroom, the dogs had followed, and during that, they managed to get some blood from the murder on their paws that they then tracked throughout the house. And this later led to some points of contention because obviously it moved the blood splatter from that room. And the police's case would state that all of the violence had occurred just in that bedroom because, as they later confirmed from the medical examiner, both Sarah and Ben had just been shot once in the head and that had killed them. So there wasn't any kind of struggle in any other area of the house, but these dog blood prints would become an issue later because the defense could point to that and say, oh, well, there's blood out here. Sarah's parents and the Bonnie's daughter, Jade, all waited outside for the police to arrive to figure out what had happened in the Bonnie household. Notably, her cousin Brian was missing from the scene. The couple's 4-year-old daughter, Jade, did provide some scant information to police, and this included that she had heard the front door open and close that night, and she also told them that a monster had killed her parents. Additionally, neighbors said that they thought they heard the sound of a truck driving around that night. So officers wondered if maybe the killer was driving that truck, and if they could find the truck, maybe they could find whoever killed the Bonnies. As police were investigating, the family was struggling to go on. I want to talk about what happened really fast to Jade just so that we can rest assured that she did have somewhere to go. After the murders, Sarah's parents adopted their 4-year-old granddaughter, Jade, who was very traumatized, as you can imagine, because she lost her parents. But not only that, she also sat in the house for hours with her parents deceased in that bedroom, which is just horrible. Over the next several years, Jade would have to go to therapy to better understand what happened and to cope with her parents' tragic deaths. Her family says that they did the best they could to keep her memories alive so that she wouldn't forget her parents. At 4 years old, she did have some memories, but you don't have that many clear memories from that age. So they had to basically make sure that she had those memories, that she knew who her parents were and how much they loved her. This included a tradition that they had where every year they would take Jade to the cemetery so that she could release balloons to send to her parents as presents. And I know that Aaron's not here, but we did talk about this case because I felt like that was so freaking sad when I heard about it the first time. And he was also incredibly sad and did his trademark, like, kind of whine, like, that's so terrible that he says, and asked me what was wrong with the person who did this. And as usual, I had to respond, something is wrong with them. Jade has had to go through all of her major milestones without both parents. And that was especially painful to the rest of the family who watched her grow up without them. And of course, her grandparents have been wonderful, but obviously she would rather have her parents there.
Today, we bask in the light of mustachioed greatness. Hi, this is Daniel Segura, host of the Mustachioed Podcastio. You like mustaches? You like movies? You like sexy chinganos? Well, the Podcastio is the place for you. We are talking legendary mustaches from Charles Bronson to the great Burt Reynolds to the OG Ice-T. Find the Mustachioed Podcastio anywhere you listen to podcasts. That is Mustachioed Podcastio.
Let's get back to this investigation, though. On December 26th of 2006, Brian Dorsey, Sarah's cousin, walked into the local police station and told them that he was the guy they were looking for. Keep in mind, this is 2 days after they found Sarah and Ben dead in their home, and 1 day after Christmas. Let's not lose focus here, as we've talked about before, about how traumatic these holiday crimes are. This family literally was gearing up for Christmas, and instead they're having to plan funerals for a murder case. Like, that is just unbearably terrible. So Brian shows up, announces that he is the person they're looking for, and that he's the one who killed Sarah and Ben. When police searched him, they found Sarah's social security card in his back pocket, and that is one of the items, by the way, that had been missing from her purse. They were also able to locate Sarah's stolen car, and that contained most of the items that had been stolen from the house, because by that point they had identified that several items had been taken. Among those items was the shotgun that had been in the shop. That shotgun was stashed in the trunk of the vehicle, and later on, investigators would be able to confirm that the shotgun was the murder weapon. Surprise. I know you're not surprised. Later, a friend of Brian's identified these stolen items in the car as things that he had tried to sell her on the morning of December 24th, which was the day after the murders. This corroborated the fact that he admitted that he had done something to the Bonnies. And there's more evidence that we're going to talk about in just a second. With these admissions, though, and this first slew of evidence, police charged Brian with 2 counts of first-degree murder. After his arrest, the court ordered that he undergo psychological and neurological testing to see if he had any mental health issues or neurological problems. If he did, his defense would be able to argue diminished capacity at his murder trial. However, the experts who examined him couldn't find anything wrong with him. And this would be very beneficial for later appeals because he would later try to argue that he did have a head injury, but because they had examined him and evaluated him for a possible head injury at the time of the murders, that argument was able to be countered. Also, in one of his appeals, he actually tried to argue that he had some sort of psychological, neurological problem because he had drank poisoned water after some sort of storm that had happened where he had lived when he was younger. And he claimed that there were chemicals in the water briefly and that he had drank them and that affected his development, which is absolutely bizarre to argue that in court documents, but he did. Thankfully, they had this examination to say, no, we didn't find any defects. Brian Dorsey did suffer from depression, but that does not explain away the murder. And while he was intoxicated at the crime, voluntary intoxication is not a defense against murder. We've actually talked about this before, but if you're experiencing psychosis because of a mental health issue, sometimes that actually is a mitigating factor that would enable you to argue that you were mentally ill at the time of a crime and maybe you need to be hospitalized rather than incarcerated. But if you are on drugs and the drugs make you psychotic, it's not treated the same way, because if you're making the choice to use the drugs and then become voluntarily intoxicated, then that's your fault for making that choice. I understand, obviously, we've talked about on this show before about substance abuse and drug dependency and how sometimes people are dependent on a drug because of an underlying issue. That is true. But just under the law, if you make the choice to do these drugs, you can't use it as a reason why you committed a crime. In a later appeal, Dorsey would still argue that his depression and substance abuse should have been mitigating factors in his case because he had other family members who had suffered from these conditions and that he was predisposed to have them, which would then make it not his fault in a way that did not work out for him. At first, when he was charged with these 2 murders, it looked like Dorsey was going to fight the charges. Because he was broke, the court assigned him 2 public defenders. And unlike most defendants, he got 2 lawyers instead of 1 because he was actually facing the death penalty if convicted. His public defenders started to review his case and quickly realized that there was a lot of evidence that showed he was guilty. Let's talk about that evidence now. Police were initially looking at him from the get-go because of the fact that he was supposed to be at the house that night and had disappeared from it. And he had a legal past. He had a criminal past. So they were already looking at him as soon as they learned about this murder. But they found some very compelling evidence that confirmed that he was their guy. Despite the fact that Sarah had bleach all over her lower body, police were able to recover some DNA that survived. It was degraded and it was inside of her, but it enabled experts to isolate the Y chromosome of the person who had left some sperm in Sarah's body, unfortunately. So this sperm only had the Y chromosome left because of how degraded it was, but they were able to compare this against the other men who had been at the scene that night. Ben was eliminated, and so was that other guest that had been left after everyone left, their friend Darren Carell. So that left them to compare it against Brian, and Brian's DNA could not be excluded from this Y chromosome. And they had to phrase it like that because of the fact that since it is degraded, they don't have enough DNA to confirm it was him, but they can basically eliminate a large portion of the population. So that is not a smoking gun clue, but it is very compelling considering who all was at the scene, that the other people that were there are eliminated, and Brian's the only one that could have been a contributor. But that's not all the DNA they had. Investigators also found Dorsey's DNA on the steering wheel inside of Sarah's stolen car and on cigarette butts that were discarded around where the car had been found. And that would suggest that he was the one that took the car and then also left it where it had been found with all those stolen items and also with the murder weapon in it. The prosecution also had statements from witnesses that were very compelling. Darren Carell was going to testify about seeing the gun in the shop that night and that he had left Brian alone in the house just before Sarah and Ben were murdered. Additionally, Brian had a friend named Patricia Canella, and she planned to testify that she had met with him that morning on around like 4 a.m. on Christmas Eve, and Brian had tried to sell all of those stolen items that had been taken from the Bonnie's house. Even though Patricia Canella wasn't exactly the most reliable person in the world, there were two other witnesses that were going to testify that they had also seen Brian trying to sell stolen items and he had talked to them about buying the things that he had gotten from the Bonnies. Another two witnesses were planning to testify about the two drug dealers who had gone to Brian's apartment that day to collect money and how Sarah and Ben had stepped in to help. But Brian still had this debt that he wanted to pay, and also he wanted to get some more drugs because he had been going through withdrawal. Not only that, but police had recorded some incriminating statements that Brian had made to the police during his interrogation. After all, he had actually come in on the day after Christmas, December 26th, and straight up told authorities that he was the man they were looking for. So that in itself seems very incriminating. All of that evidence came together to present a pretty compelling case that Brian Dorsey had in fact murdered Sarah and Ben Bonney while they slept in their beds. And he was able to do all that simply because they had helped him. Based on all the evidence and Dorsey's statements, here's what investigators say happened that night. After the family friend Darren Carell left, Brian started drinking that bottle of vodka, but that wasn't enough for him. He really wanted some drugs, and so he started to formulate a truly horrible plan. Remember that shotgun that was lying on the pool table? Well, this case is a lot like a play or a novel in that if you show a gun in Act 1, the audience is going to expect you to use it by Act 3. And that's just what Brian decided to do. He grabbed that shotgun and went into the Bonnie's house with a plan. Creeping into the couple's bedroom, Brian pointed the gun at their sleeping forms and fired. He shot Sarah first, and the bullet entered at her jaw. Then he reloaded the single-shot shotgun and shot Ben by his right ear. After shooting the couple, Brian sexually assaulted his cousin Sarah's deceased body, which is how that sperm was left inside her. To cover up that violation, he poured bleach on Sarah's lower body, including her torso, genital area, and her upper thighs, in an attempt to get rid of his DNA. Next, he moved on to his main goal, stealing from his cousin and her husband, the two people who had rescued him earlier that day and had generously invited him to stay in their home. He started with Sarah's wallet, looking for money. He took her social security card and then just discarded the items around her. He looted the house for items he thought he could sell and put them in Sarah's car, which he also intended to sell for cash. Chillingly, at one point, he went into 4-year-old Jade's room, where she was sleeping. She woke up, though, and she asked her cousin where her parents were. He told her that she couldn't see them. Thankfully, he left and didn't kill Jade, too. Now that the couple were dead, Brian had stolen those items and took them in Sarah's car. And just as a by the way, one of the items he stole was in fact the shotgun, and he did plan to sell that and had offered it for sale to the people he talked to. He also had stolen a ring that was engraved with Sarah's name and the name of an ex-boyfriend who also happened to be named Brian. And he stole Ben's cell phone. Brian's next stop was to see a woman named Patricia Canella, who'd loaned him money for drugs in the past. He also alleges that Patricia sold him drugs. She would deny that for obvious not incriminating herself for later reasons, but we can't be sure if she was a dealer or just a money loaning person. He showed up at Patricia's house at around 4 a.m. on Christmas Eve and offered to sell her some of the items that he had stole from the Bonnies to pay her back for the loans. He also wanted some additional cash to buy more drugs. Brian drove Sarah's car around the city completely intoxicated, trying to sell the items he stole to anyone who would take them. He was telling everyone he encountered that the car was his, and he continued to drink the vodka that he'd found as he made his weird little trek around the city. He remained out and about on his little crime spree for 2 days, from Christmas Eve all the way till December 26th, when he turned himself into police. With evidence so strong, the defense attorneys did not think they could present a compelling argument in favor of Dorsey's innocence. If they went to trial, his lawyers believed that he would be convicted of the murders and sentenced to death. The only thing they could think to do to help him was to try to play the only card they had. He could accept responsibility by pleading guilty and essentially throw himself on the mercy of the court. They explained this to Dorsey, telling him that if you go to trial, they're going to convict you. You're going to die. But we could try to persuade the court that you're really sorry. You're accepting responsibility. We should get some life in prison instead. And Dorsey agreed to this. In March 2008, he pleaded guilty to 2 counts of first-degree murder for killing Sarah and Ben. He thought that pleading guilty would help him escape the death penalty, but there was a problem. The plea agreement didn't say anything about a sentencing recommendation or agreement. So, the state still planned to pursue the death penalty. This is partially because part of Sarah's family really, really wanted the death penalty because of how traumatic this whole issue was for them. I will tell you that the family's desires were very divided, but there was definitely a group of family members that this was what felt like justice to them. And I think that's why the prosecution decided to go after the death penalty. Because they were pursuing the death penalty, a jury trial would still be held for the sentencing portion of this case because a judge can't just make that decision on their own. The jury heard the entire prosecution's case with all that evidence about DNA and also the fact that Dorsey had admitted his own guilt. After deliberating, the jury recommended a sentence of death for each count of murder because Dorsey committed these crimes while engaged in sexual assault and burglary. Additionally, he killed 2 people at the same time, and all 3 of these things are in extenuating circumstances that heighten the crime, essentially. The jury felt like they pretty much had to give him the death penalty because of the fact that there were these 3 extenuating circumstances. The judge agreed with the jury and sentenced Brian Dorsey to die. Because of this death sentence, this case became super famous. It especially heated up this last year because in 2023, the Missouri Attorney General, Andrew Bailey, asked the Missouri Supreme Court to set an execution date to carry out Dorsey's sentence. By that point, he had already gone through multiple appeals of his sentence that had been denied. And so the court went ahead and set the date for April 9th of 2024, which is literally just over a week ago. With his death date set, prison officials moved Dorsey to solitary confinement as he awaited execution. This meant he could no longer work as a prison barber, which he had been doing while he was in jail for the past roughly a decade. And also, he couldn't spend time with the people he'd met in prison anymore. As a side note, the reason why death penalty prisoners are often isolated is because they are considered a bigger risk since they have nothing to lose. In the past, there have been death penalty prisoners who had essentially attacked and assaulted and murdered other prisoners and also guards and other staff members because what are you going to do? Put them to death more than once? At that point, there's no higher consequence. So as a safety precaution, they go ahead and move death penalty prisoners into isolation so that they can't interact with other people that they might harm, whether or not there's any risk of them actually harming them. Once he was moved into isolation, people started coming out in support of Dorsey, especially staff members that he had worked with while he was in prison. And this was probably what made his case so unique. There were a lot of prison employees, roughly 70 or so prison employees, who came forward and wrote letters on his behalf and signed this massive letter on his behalf, and some of which even talked to news media outlets about how he's a changed man, that Dorsey that they know is a good guy. He's worked as a barber and never hurt anybody. He's not had any infractions. And they thought that his sentence should be commuted. He also had some new lawyers, and they were arguing a lot of different things to try to get some clemency. One of the things that had been argued was that he was in a drug-induced psychosis and didn't remember murdering or sexually assaulting anyone, and that somehow that is a mitigating factor. Dorsey also pointed out that he had an exemplary record in prison. He didn't have any infractions. He had been working a job there. Essentially, he said that he was unique and that he had been completely rehabilitated and was now essentially a productive member of society, and asked for life in prison without parole instead of the death penalty. One of the biggest pleas for clemency, though, had to do with how his public defenders were paid. Because at the time that Dorsey went on trial initially, public defenders were just assigned a flat fee for their work. So they didn't get paid per hour. They got paid the same amount no matter how many hours they worked. In this case, each of his public defenders received $12,000 for their work on his case. And according to his appeals attorneys, this gave them an incentive to do less work. And as a result, Dorsey says that's why he was pressured into taking a plea deal without negotiating the terms, and also why his lawyers didn't take time to consider any mitigating factors. On the flip side, these attorneys have pointed out that they actually still paid an independent investigator to do a bunch of work on his case and have also just outlined the evidence that's in his file. There was never any doubt that Dorsey is the one who killed Sarah and Ben. In fact, in his appeals, for the most part, he hasn't ever said that he didn't shoot Sarah and Ben that night. All of his claims, including some where he tries to say he's factually innocent of first-degree murder, he still admits that he would be guilty in that theoretical world where it wasn't first-degree murder, of a different level of murder because he did shoot them. He just thinks that he shouldn't be punished for that high crime. So I'm not exactly sure what his lawyers could have done except for asking that he serve life in prison. I think the problem is, though, is that the prosecution most likely would not have agreed to that because, as we're going to talk about in 1 second, there are members, immediate members, including Sarah's parents, who really felt like the only way for them to get justice was for Dorsey to face the death penalty. So I just think that the lawyers kind of were in a tight spot where, regardless of how they went about this, there was no scenario where the state wasn't going to pursue the death penalty. And going to trial was not going to make him not get that punishment, if that makes sense. Like, the same case was going on regardless. Dorsey's supporters, and there were many, put together a petition for his sentence commutation that would go to Missouri Governor Mike Parson, who was a Republican. Governor Parson previously worked as a sheriff, and although he has commuted other sentences for lesser crimes, he's actually never commuted any death penalty sentences since he's taken office. So this was kind of a long shot, but they decided to try for it. Over 70 of the prison staff who worked with Dorsey supported his pleas for clemency, and one of the men who supervised him, Timothy Lancaster, went on record and described Dorsey as kind and respectful and said that executing him would be a pointless cruelty. Dorsey's supporters also included religious officials, mental health advocates, and law professors, as well as many members of the public. And I think they did put together a good packet, essentially, to argue why he shouldn't be executed. And as you know from listening to other episodes of this podcast, Aaron and I don't support the death penalty, except that we understand that some people do, if that makes sense. And so Aaron is more staunchly opposed to it. Essentially, he less understands why people go after it in the first place. I am very against the death penalty, but also I understand why families ask for it. And I feel like sometimes it's not my place to interfere with what a family feels like they need for recovery. So it's like really a tight spot because I do think that killing more people is not helpful. I don't think it's a deterrent. I think it's grossly misapplied because there are so many more people of color who are put on death row. And I know I've mentioned this before, but one of the pivotal moments in my life where I realized just how bad the death penalty could be was when I was reading about a man who was killed when I lived in Beaumont and the nearby correctional facility there. But he had been incarcerated for capital murder when he did not actually commit the crime. He was doing a robbery with some friends, which is wrong and bad. Obviously, he should go to jail for that. But one of his friends, against his other friend's knowledge, one of the friends had brought a gun along and shot one of the victims, which again is horrible. And even though I definitely feel like all of the people in that group should have been held accountable, the actual shooter is the one who took the deal from police and immediately confessed and told what happened, and he got a lesser sentence, whereas this other innocent guy who, I mean, innocent of murder, but you know what I mean, he's the one that got executed. Like, he didn't even fire the gun. And I just don't think it's okay that someone who didn't even kill anybody is getting executed. And it definitely, I cannot be convinced otherwise that it's not because he's black. Because he was black, spoilers. And I genuinely think that that's the reason why he got the death penalty. And that is horrible. So I don't think that as a developed society, we should be doing the death penalty. But in this case, I understand why the governor and the appeals board were in such a dilemma, because there were several people in Sarah and Ben's families that really wanted this to happen. I will tell you that there were people, including shared relatives between Sarah, the victim, and Brian, the murderer, that supported Brian because apparently they claimed that he was a nice guy that had one bad day. Sarah's parents, who found the deceased bodies and also who have raised a traumatized child, feel like justice is only going to be served by this death sentence. And they wrote a very compelling letter. Like, honestly, it was very heart-wrenching whenever I read it. And so I totally understand where they're coming from. I feel like because of the family's pleas to let this sentence be carried out, that the governor was caught in a position where there was no way in hell that he was going to give clemency. And that is the decision that he made, was to not give clemency. Still, Dorsey appealed his case all the way up to the Missouri State court system and all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And over and over again, the various courts denied his appeals. As April 9th, 2024 approached, Dorsey's supporters took to the news to advocate for him. And you may have seen this case splashed all over the headlines because that's what brought it to my attention. And some of those headlines were extremely graphic because you kind of had two sides. One was talking about all of the prison employees that supported him. And then there was a flip side of people talking about how graphic the execution could be. Brian Dorsey was overweight at the time that he was going to be put to death. He was, I believe, diabetic, but he also had been an intravenous drug user before he was incarcerated. And as a result, it was possible that they wouldn't be able to find a good vein. So his supporters had been like, look, if they can't find a good vein, then they're going to have to do surgery without anesthetic because there's a rule that they don't use anesthetics during executions. So in order to get this vein, essentially, like, not to be graphic, but they were going to have to cut his arm open and like dig around to get to the vein. And that obviously would be incredibly disgusting because of obvious reasons. And it would cause him extreme pain. And that's just, it's both barbaric and also would interfere with him, like talking to his religious person that's going to be with him. That I feel like was a pretty compelling argument, but the jail staff was like, don't worry, we have a plan. It's going to be fine. They didn't say what the plan was though. In his final appeal, before he was set to be executed, Dorsey argued that he was factually innocent of first-degree murder because he could not deliberate at the time of the crime because of his intoxication level and the fact that he was crashing from crack cocaine withdrawal. As I mentioned earlier, he said in this argument that he had been awake for around 72 hours and therefore he was out of his mind, he was completely psychotic, and could not have been guilty of first-degree murder, which meant that he would have been guilty of a lesser offense, and the lesser offense wouldn't have the death penalty attached to it, so therefore he couldn't be put to death. Which honestly, I feel like was his best argument, and probably should have just gone with that from the get-go, but there were some problems with it. Because whether or not he was out of his mind or very intoxicated, there are some things that suggest that he was able to plan and deliberate. First of all, that gun was not loaded when he picked it up to shoot Sarah and Ben Bonney. He had to load the gun, which takes deliberation and planning. Additionally, it was a single shot shotgun, so he had to actually load it again before he could shoot Ben after he shot Sarah. Also, we know there was the sexual assault, but afterwards, he got bleach, poured it on Sarah's body, and then left that bleach container on the bathroom cabinet where no reasonable person would leave a bleach container unless they were, you know, committing a crime. He was able to loot the house and then drive to a friend's house and have a conversation about the items he wanted to steal and continued to have multiple conversations with other people about things that he was trying to sell that he had stolen from the house. These are all things that require some sort of contemplation, you know, and some sort of planning. He also lied and said the car was his, not Sarah's. And these are things that you do because you're trying to cover a crime up. You know what I mean? Like, he wouldn't have poured the bleach if he didn't know that he needed to cover up his DNA. He wouldn't have said the car was his if he didn't know that he needed to lie about whose car he was driving. There's some level of awareness here that suggests that he is planning and calculating in some form or another, which means that there's enough evidence to convict him of first-degree murder, essentially. And that is why that argument also did not help. He also tried to claim that flat fee defense again, saying that his lawyers were ineffective because of it, but this had already been rejected, so it was rejected again. And then finally, he made a new exciting claim and argued that his execution would violate the Eighth Amendment because he was so remarkably rehabilitated while in prison. He basically said that since he had been rehabilitated, it was unconstitutional to put him to death, which is a fun argument. And I think the lawyers who put that together are super creative and I would love to talk to them. But The court was not feeling that. They did not agree that the Eighth Amendment was relevant here, and so they also dismissed that. That meant that April 9th, 2024 rolled around and no one had provided any sort of clemency for Dorsey. And so his execution went forward. He ate his final meal at 11 a.m. local time. He ordered a pizza, 2 bacon double cheeseburgers, 2 orders of chicken strips, and 2 orders of fries. Around that same time, he also had a last visit with his spiritual advisor. The state of Missouri executed Brian Dorsey on April 9, 2024 at 6:11 p.m. local time, and he shared the following last words that he had written out. Quote, "To all the family and loved ones I share with Sarah, and to all the surviving family and loved ones of Ben, I am truly, deeply, and overwhelmingly sorry. Words cannot hold the just weight of my guilt and shame. I still love you. I never wanted to hurt anyone. I am sorry I hurt them and you. To my family, friends, and all those that tried to prevent this, I love you. I am grateful for you. I have peace in my heart in large part because of you, and I thank you. To those on all sides of this sentence, I carry no ill will or anger, only acceptance and understanding." Unquote. The Missouri Department of Corrections has said that the execution went smoothly. At the time he was executed, some of his supporters were actually outside cheering slash protesting. And it's definitely, it's a complicated situation, especially because he was executed with phenobarbital, which is not normally used to execute prisoners. And so there are questions about whether or not it's okay to use slash humane. And definitely that's something, I guess, as a society that we will have to keep questioning. I've spent a lot of time talking about this with Aaron because, again, after I read about this initially, I had to tell him what I was thinking. And we talked a lot about all the death penalty issues because, to me, it's really hard once you tell a family that that's what the sentence is. It's hard to take that away because I feel like whenever we're doing these stories, or like whenever you're reading about true crime or you're, you know, a jury or whatever it is, whatever your contact with the true crime case is, the families and the victims are the most important part of it. And if a family believes that they are going to get this type of justice and this is what they feel like they need to recover, you can't tell them they can have it and then take it away. And so I feel like that was a conflict that I had with this, is that, you know, her family had been looking forward to having this chapter closed for them, and they felt like him being put to death would close that chapter. I mean, not the entire family, but some of them, because there were definitely some supporters on Dorsey's side that thought he should just spend the rest of his life in prison. But regardless, these central figures in the case had wanted this to happen. And so I feel like it's a lot harder for the governor or anyone else to provide clemency in that case because they're already hurt and you don't want to hurt them again. But at the same time, I think that the best way for us to start kind of moving away from the death penalty is just to stop giving it as a sentence in the first place. And then we can kind of work our way backwards with the people who are already on death row and figure out how we can make more conscious decisions about what we're doing with this. I don't know if that makes sense. I just feel like that's kind of a compromise because none of us really can say exactly what's always right or wrong. I'm not really sure. I feel like if Aaron were here, he would be telling me that there is just one right and one wrong here and that we just shouldn't be using the death penalty at all. It's hard because I both agree with that and also understand why some people don't feel that way. Does that make sense? I feel like it might make sense. But I definitely think we need to make some changes. And I just think it would help if we just stopped doing that as a sentence in the first place. And then we can kind of sift through what's left. And that way we won't have any families that are essentially looking for this closure and then we just take it away from them. But we can hopefully work on saving some of these people who shouldn't be executed before it actually happens. That obviously is my opinion. I will say there has been another change after this case as well that doesn't have to do with the death penalty, but in the years after Dorsey's case, the Missouri public defender system shifted away from those flat fees for death penalty cases And that was just in case it does encourage some lawyers to settle cases quickly. And so since, you know, cases that are death penalty related are more labor intensive, it's better to offer that, you know, pay per hour type thing and make sure that the people who are working on the cases are getting compensated somewhat adequately for the work that they're doing, to hopefully not somehow encourage them to settle cases quickly, because definitely we don't want that. But yeah, that's the case of Sarah and Ben Bonney. I told Aaron when we were talking about this that the fact that they both answered the phone when their troubled family member was calling, because I feel like some of us, probably myself included, if we had someone like Brian Dorsey who was a consistent mess, you know, who had a criminal past, who was actively using, who was constantly getting money from people, constantly in debt with drug dealers, constantly bringing this type of trouble around, I feel like, just being real, as much as I don't want to admit it, I probably wouldn't have answered the phone. I'm just going to be honest about that. I kind of feel a little disappointed in myself, because I know that drug dependency is not like evil, and that, you know, people can come back from that. And also sometimes it's just a mental health issue. And obviously, you know, that since we ourselves have mental health issues, we are very understanding of that. At the same time, I just don't feel like I would have answered the phone in the first place. I would have been like, oh, he's just going to ask for money, not answering the phone. But then to like go over there and put yourself in danger to help someone that you love, invite them over to your house and help them, only to be immediately murdered by them, is just fucking, it's just messed up. And I feel like it shows you what good people they were that they even brought him over there in the first place, because no one else stepped up to do that. It was just them. And I just think that part of the reason why there's such a cliche in true crime podcast of like, oh, they lit up the room, oh, they were so generous, they were so giving, they would give you the shirt off their back, is because these people are unfortunately murdered a lot by people taking advantage of them. And that's fucked up. And I am sad about it. And I'm sure you're sad about it now too. And that's kind of my fault and my bad. All right. Well, I'm sorry Aaron couldn't be here today because he is at work. Please do come see us at Conclusa though. I think you're going to have a good time. I personally am already making a list of people that I want to see. I cannot wait for the panel schedule to come out, because I know that we're going to be on some panels most likely. I have been invited to be on a Women in Podcasting panel that I will probably be on, but I haven't gotten final confirmation on that. So you can definitely see me on that panel, but I want to go to some of these book panels. I don't know about y'all, but I am down for some book panels. There's an author coming that I want to see, so pretty excited about that. Definitely come out there. Also, the Instagram is back up and going. Follow us on social media. We're on all of them at BadAxePod, except for, I don't think I put the podcast on Threads, if I'm being honest. But you can totally hook up with us there, and I've been posting more. I'm going to try to put the wedding photo I told you guys about from Ben and Sarah's wedding up there, so you can go check that out later. Also, some more information about what's going to be going on at Ye Olde Comic Palooza. And if you want to follow me on my personal Instagram, it's daydreams_of_pretty. And I will not be weirded out if you follow me. It's totally cool. I'm chill. I'm super chill. I have a lot of cat pictures there of the kitty cats because they are being cute 24/7. So you can go and look at those kitty cats. Also, there are sometimes pictures of us doing something. This month, I'm really focused on books. There's an indie bookstore day on April 27th. And I think we've talked about this before, but I'm a writer. So I like love to write and I love to read. And so we've been going to a lot of bookstores this month because we're doing a Houston independent bookstore crawl. There are so many independent bookstores in the city of Houston. I did not realize how many there are, even though I had patronized some of them before, but now I know there's even more than I even knew about. So definitely check out which ones you have in your city. Let's just keep some independent bookstores alive. Also, this is kind of like a pre-early announcement, but I also have a poetry book that's being published early next year with a publisher called Finishing Line Press. Very excited about this. And I will be telling you guys when it's available for pre-order, but that's not happening yet. I just was thinking about it because it's also Poetry Month, which is awesome. There's so many things that are happening, you guys. Like, I am just losing it. I have had a sinus infection and I have been taking some medicine for it. And I feel like it's made me muted today and a little bit loopy, but hopefully it's helping because I've been like, you know how sinus infections are. I've been trying to figure out why I felt so bad. And then I was describing why I felt bad because I thought I was just being a poop. And then as I was describing my like symptoms, Aaron was like, are you sick though? And that's when I realized I was sick and not a poop. All right. Well, I'm going to let you go. It's been over an hour of just me talking. You probably don't want that, right? So I will check in with you later on this week. That's a lie. I'm going to check in with everybody, though, next week for sure with a new episode. And also the patrons can keep an eye out on some new patrons-only content. If you are not already a patron, please go over to patreon.com/bagspod, link in our show notes. We put out 3 bonus episodes every single month. There's a mini episode for the $1 tier. For $5, you get the mini episode and a full episode. Also, the mini episode is usually pretty long, considering. And then if you go for a full $10, you get a special extra third episode that is our recent crimes, current events type update, where it's usually 3 or 4 different crimes that are in the news. And it's always like the most insane things I can find. Like some really weird, messed up stuff that why are people doing this? Essentially the things that make us go on and on and on with our like PSAs of like, stop murdering people because it's wrong. Like, is no one telling you that it's wrong? Because it is wrong and you should not do it. Okay, well, have an amazing weekend and bye-bye.